author of The Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Hi, I'm Liza Klausman, author of Villa America, out in April.
As well as highly recommendable Tigers in Red Weather. Villa America is a very different book from Tigers in Red Weather, in the sense that you took real people.
It's biographical in nature, somewhat. I mean, there's definitely there's also a highly fictional element in it, so it's kind of corrupted in that way. But yes, it's based on the real lives of Sarah and Gerald Murphy, who were American expatriates in Paris and Antibes in the 1920s, and found themselves at the center of this literary and artistic community that included Picasso and F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway and Cole Porter, and the list sort of goes on and on. And were written about quite extensively by that crew, or painted or whatever, but served as muses ultimately. One of the things that led me to the couple was doing my master's degree in Tenders the Night, which is dedicated to Sarah and Gerald, Many Fet, by Fitzgerald. And it turns out he says that he based that book on them, and they strongly disagreed.
Yes.
And I would have to sort of agree with them on that. I think it is more of a Zelda and Scott book, but it's still got elements of their life, mm-hmm. and who mm-hmm. they were in there.
And they did. I mean, they were the ones who... the quote, you know, the best revenge is to live well.
Living well is the best revenge. Yeah, I think actually, I'm not sure they made up that quote. Mm. That's something Calvin Tompkins named the book. But I think that there's also some suggestion that they found that quote a little bit weird because they never felt like they were taking revenge on anyone.
Mm-hmm. They were just living their lives.
Yes, yes.
And they had a very unusual, both of them, you know, separately, had very unusual upbringing. And you evoke... I know it's fiction, but you really do evoke sort of the sort of ghastly coldness of Gerald's upbringing.
Yeah.
And the sort of gilded cage.
Yeah, and I think that that's pretty much based on fact. The episode that sort of happens quite at the beginning of the book with Gerald's dog, in fact, is a real episode in his life. And I think, that description of his family life is one that he gave of his family life. So, I mean, that's what I'm going on, in essence. And Sarah's the same. I read their diaries. You read these things by them. And, you know, I mean, her diaries, you know, at a certain point, just day after day, you know, taking the waters, going to the marriage market, you know, going back to the marriage market, going back to the tea room. I mean, just basically your life was about, you know, sort of sitting around doing nothing or trying to get married. Mm-hmm. And...
Being sort of in this living tableau that her mother had created, but didn't want them. She didn't want them married.
No, she wanted them to stay with her. I think that those elements of the beginning of their that sort of describe the beginning of their their lives before each other, they were pretty based on factual research and.
Mm. And what was it about them in particular that drew you? I mean, they were at the center of this.
Yeah, I mean, they have this sort of X factor. I think that's what drew a lot of people to want to sort of write about them or to sort of capture them in some way. So they had this way of making life seem just magic. Mm. I think that's such an enticing subject. You know, mm-hmm. you sort of figure out why is the question. You know, I think a book is also about you answering a question for yourself. It's a thing that you're working out on each page, you know, that you don't know the answer to maybe until you get to the end, maybe not even then, but... I think that, you know, that was definitely, for me, when I was writing the book, I was thinking to myself, you know, what is it that makes these people so attractive to other people that it allows them to sort of, is it their generosity? Is it their attention to detail? Is it their eye? Is it their creativity? What is it? You know, is it their beauty? And you're just trying to figure that out. And
so, flowers, gala, party.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but I don't think they were frivolous. I was reading... a Paris Review article recently, which I just did not agree with at all. It referred to them as dilettantes. And I sort of have to take issue with that. I don't think they're dilettantes. I mean, I think he was quite a great painter. He just wasn't prolific, nor was he great at kind of maintaining his legacy. But I think that they were just people who had built this world for themselves, and other people were attracted to them. I don't think they were trying to glom on to the artist, per se, you know? which would suggest more of dilettantism.
Well, no, sir, I do think there is a modern parallel, because a lot of people, especially with inexpensive flights to Europe, a lot of people in England or in other parts of Europe were living, you know, if the euro was cheaper, you could live better off the euro in Barcelona, for example. You know, and they were sort of like the Hemingways were certainly doing that.
They were all doing currency,
you know, sort of currency exchange and living where they could live well for less.
Well, when I left college, I moved to Paris and lived there. It was when, you know, before the euro and the franc, and the dollar was so strong, and you could, you know, you lived so much better.
Yeah.
And it was part of, you know, the glamour of being there.
Exactly. And if you had the imagination and the ability to do it, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly. If you could get a job and, you know, manage the bureaucracy, why wouldn't you do it? Exactly.
Yeah, why wouldn't you? Yeah, for me it was very interesting reading the book, because I felt like I had just read Naomi Wood's Mrs. Hemingway, so about the four Hemingway wives, which is also incredibly evoked. But yeah, I felt like I'd been immersed in the south of France.
Yeah, you know? And you just went through a whole, like, lost generation experience sitting here. Yeah.
And the Murphys.
You're kind of like, I'm good with these guys now.
Yeah, exactly. And the Murphys do thread in, thread out of.
Yeah, I read parts of Mrs. Hemingway only because I was writing my book when hers came out, and I really didn't. I was really kind of afraid to read it.
Yeah.
You don't want to kind of steal something or be influenced or whatever. But I did. I couldn't, you know, not take a peek at some things. And also, you know, because I really quite like her and wanted to, you know, be able to at least say, oh, I read part of it, and I think it's beautiful. But her, like, evocation of the Murphys, I was like, well, that's not what the Murphys are like. Yeah. Because I think you start to really quite own these people, which aren't even yours to own, and they're real people, you know. But you own your viewpoint, I guess, on them.
Yeah, your take on them, yes. Yeah. And did you feel it, because, again, okay, speaking about your first book, Tigers in Red Weather, talk about some incredibly strong and strongly evoked characters. Did you feel the same sense of ownership over them as you did over...
Well, yes, but I probably didn't really, like, think about it that much because I created them. Do you know? I mean, I feel ownership over Owen, who's a fictional character, but I don't... It doesn't surprise me that I feel that way since he's a product of my imagination. Whereas the Murphys, whenever I feel that ownership, I have to sort of check myself and be like, no, they're real. Yeah, they lived. They don't belong to you, you know. So I think that's where it's just more surprising.
Listen to us online, on your phone, download a podcast, or on your tablet. Radio Gorgeous, there for you.
And how did you start writing, and how did Tigers in Red Weather come about? Because that's sort of just, it's quite an explosive book.
I did my master's degree here, and I started writing my novel then. It was a master's degree in creative writing at Royal Holloway. And so I got sort of a third of the way through the novel and got an agent and just kept writing it. And then, you know, it surprised me as much as anyone that there was people wanted it, you know. It's great, so it sold, and yay.
Yeah.
It is a dream come true, right? It's sort of a, like, fairy tale story.
Yeah.
It just all went the way it was supposed to go. So obviously the second novel then is always a bit tricky. Because you're like, oh, that was quite a little too lucky, maybe, you know.
And that book, I did want to talk a bit about it, because for me, I mean, it really does evoke more, you know, the Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, whatever, but still the Hamptons and possibly the North Coast, even more, of Long Island, of these American East Coast sort of moneyed summers. And the you know, similar to this, the cocktails are flowing. And all the, I love that there's always a subtext to what that does. That there's a, it's almost like, you know, a southern, like Magnolia's being too sweet. There's something corruptive about it, which you don't explore explicitly. But it seems to me that corrosive element.
Yeah, I mean, for me, when I thought, you know, that novel, you know, much this one has nothing, then doesn't have that sort of element to it. But that novel definitely had that kind of, like, the floor, there's some, you know, it's, the foundations are rotting, you know? Everything looks, is well painted. It's sort of like one of those houses, the money pit houses or whatever.
Yes.
And it looks nice, but actually inside things are just crumbling. And I sort of how I felt about, you know, that was kind of in my mind when I was creating that community of people. Which isn't entirely indicative. I mean, it is a fantasy, you know, it's a noir-esque look at, you know, what that could be like. But I do think some of those you know, some of those ideas are definitely relevant in the sense that, you know, there's a division between a lot of those summer people and the year-round people who live in mm-hmm. those towns mm-hmm. and the kind of friction that can go on. Mm-hmm. Sort of selfishness, perhaps, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And things brushed under the floorboards, but really...
Oh, yeah, well, that's just being a wasp, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. and sort of missed opportunities for reality, yeah. you know, and for yeah. and for real connection.
Yeah,
Going for a surface look instead.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And it's very, very different feel to Villa America. But the other thing about it is that, okay, so they had this incredibly, you know, gilded life, it seemed like. But they were in a lot of essence just living their lives. You know, they wanted it to be beautiful and they wanted to do things nice. But mm-hmm. I mean, Sarah's, you know, she was intensely involved with her children.
Yeah.
You know, as was Gerald.
Yeah.
You know, and he was very hardworking at his painting mm-hmm. and she was like, you know, this doesn't, you know, I still have to do all this stuff. You know,
yeah.
I'm still running a household.
Yeah.
I'm still taking care of kids.
Yeah, and I think that they also, like, had a kind of, it's just sort of different the way that they, I mean, for a while, they didn't have office jobs. So that's just one thing. But I kind of feel like the way we raise children now and the way they raise children then is very, very different. There's much mm-hmm. more liberal upbringing than we, mm-hmm. you know, now
yes.
it's all very regimented. And even, you know, getting children to sleep, I mean, it's just sort of like books are written about it, you know? and I think it's just different. People may see that as, maybe people find that romantic. You mm-hmm. know, I think everything not being so stitched up.
Mm-hmm.
So prescribed, I guess. Mm-hmm. Coming back to your point, they're working hard. It may just not look as like they're working as hard, because they don't follow the same rules that we've all sort of, you know, taken now as gospel.
But at the same time, I mean, they were dealt such tragic blows as well.
Yeah, I mean, no one can say they had it easy in the end.
No.
I think, you know, it was their sort of... And I think that may be part of it, too. You know, they have this sort of... In all of that tragedy, they have this sort of profound grace,
mm-hmm.
you
yeah.
know? And I think that that says something about the character of these people.
Yeah.
It's an amazing character. Not everyone can, and not that everyone needs to, but if you are that strong and that kind of self-contained, it's an amazing gift.
Yeah.
You know?
I was going to say, because that, obviously, you know, we're not giving any plot points away, because it's documented, because they were real people, that two of their children died in short succession, and when especially she had gone to such great lengths to protect them and all this milk drinking
God,
of the
and
local cows
their coins and you know maybe.
Yeah, you know, she was a real germaphobe,
yeah.
and then to have lost two children regard you know despite
yeah.
that is that you know wasn't even it just speaks to the further blow.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
Now, their marriage survived that.
Yeah.
Their marriage also survived... how much... Okay, so we'll say there's a homosexual element, you know,
yeah.
Gerald's sexuality being somewhat questioned. Was that documented? Was that questioned?
I think
that
his
question
struggle
arise?
Is well documented.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, he refers to it in a couple of letters to his friend Archie MacLeish as his defect that he's known that he's lived with for ever since he was 15 years old, that he's tried to scotch, that, you know.
Mm.
So, I mean, I think the language is pretty implicit to me what that means.
Yeah.
Furthermore, he writes to Sarah saying, you know, on topic X, I feel so terrible, I can't even mention it. Like, I know that you need more communicated affection.
Well,
that I'm incapable of giving you.
Yeah.
And I also take communicated affection to mean
yeah.
sex.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of sort of beating around the bush, so to
yeah.
speak. But, you know, I think it's there. I think it's pretty clear. And there's something also about, there's a lot of photographs of him, you know, going around sort of nude, being photographed naked. And that doesn't suggest necessarily sort of some kind of homosexuality, but it suggests some kind of, I think, issue with the way you're portrayed, how you feel in your own clothes and in your own body, you know?
Yeah.
Which just, again, suggests something that's not being expressed properly.
Mm-hmm.
Or not being given an outlet
mm-hmm.
that's
mm-hmm.
out in the open.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I guess anyone, you could make a case for something different, I think, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's not like a sort of, he says, you know, I'm gay and... but I'm married.
Mm-hmm.
There's never that explicit. But for me, that's what it meant. Mm-hmm. And he clearly loved her, and they clearly had sex, you know. Mm-hmm. So I kind of felt like, you know, there was a bisexuality, there was an attraction to men that was stifled.
Mm-hmm. So. And did definitely. I loved the scene with the flamboyantly gay and very married Cole Porter and his wife.
Yeah.
And that, the way you write it, it's really fun because you build up such a strong marriage with these two, such a sympathy, such a need to be with each other, and that this is also true.
Mm.
And you know what? We should be able to house more.
The conflicting notions.
Yes,
yeah, well, I think
exactly.
That's life, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think...
And I think we do that.
Yeah, we just don't always... I think there is something, you know, I'm kind of fascinated by monogamy because I just don't know how that works. Do you know? Because I can understand you want to be married to the person that you love, but that then you're going to have attractions to other
mm-hmm.
people. And I think the suggestion that you aren't, is that we never allowed to talk about it, or, you know what I mean? I think there's something in that that's so crazy.
It's sort of like, to me also, like you're squashing it down. It's like the mayonnaise in the sandwich. It's going to pop outside.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot
of you don't talk about it.
It must be a great disappointment to a lot of people who find out, oh my God, I am attracted to somebody else. I never knew this was going to happen. They never told me about this, you know?
Yeah.
So you get married young or whatever, you know? And I think, so for me, it doesn't, yeah, I think you can have both. But I think that's a difficult notion maybe to sell.
Yes. Well, it's also difficult to sell some.
Yeah, in our society, we like it black and white. We do,
yes.
you know, shades of gray, not so much.
Yeah, and if we're going to get married, I thought that was about me.
Yeah,
I thought that wasn't about everyone else that's also in this bed.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, yeah,
realized, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that also at the time the choices were limited.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I don't know if they were any more limited because now we still look down on people who are bisexual and say choose.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's like what did they say in Sex and the City? Oh, it's just the stop on the route to Ricky Martinville. I think that's true. I think that they are sort of second class citizens.
Yeah.
You know, both the gay community and the straight community is like,
Well, and also I think why it would create confusion in oneself.
Hmm.
Finally, I have to ask you a very important question for radio courses. What makes the perfect martini?
Well, it depends how you like it. I like mine really dry.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually...
Are we talking gin or vodka?
I prefer vodka, shockingly. I really do.
Oh, my God.
I know. I prefer vodka. I like it very, very cold. I think the Hemingway Bar... it's a great plug, but it's true. They make an amazing martini called the Platinum Bullet.
Ah.
I think they keep it at some obscenely low degree, and it is so cold when it comes out.
I love it.
And they don't serve. I mean, if I were going to doctor it, I would add extra olives. I think they serve it with just a flour. I mean, I think it's supposed to be just that. And you are quite trolleyed by the time you finish it, but it is wonderful. So for me, if I were making my own, I think the glass should be cold. I think it should just be rinsed with the vermouth, the vodka shaken in, and extra olives. That would be for me perfect.
Perfect martini. And I always...
Would you prefer the gin?
I prefer the gin.
Yeah.
The cold, absolutely.
Yeah.
And three olives.
Oh, I see six. I'd like a snack as well to go with it.
Three in, three on the side. Excellent. Well, cheers.
All right, cheers.
Thank
we'll
you
do
so
that
much.
Next time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Next time, as you say, next time Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Next time the Hemingway Bar.
Yeah, exactly. I'll see you there for a Platinum Bullet.
Thank you, Liza.
Thank you so much.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
My sin a row, tree blind, my steer they go, marching down the street single file, to a calypso beat all the while. They're looking for the cat that swallowed the rat. They want to show that cat the attitude of tree blind mice. and dear. Tree blind mice everywhere, searching all around for the cat. All over Kingston town, pitter-pat, they got the carving knife to cut the pussycat's life. The puss will get that knife for trifling with tree blind mice. So beware, tree blind mice, watch your step. Tree blind mice, deadly mice. Tree blind mice, where they go. Tree blind mice, what they do. Tree blind mice, body mice. Tree blind mice, deadly mice.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.